Welcome to today's Platinum Asset Management Quarterly Advisor Conference Call. I am pleased to present Douglas Isles. For the first part of this call, all participants will be in listen-only mode, and afterwards there will be a question and answer session. Douglas, please begin.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. I will give you an overview of world markets, followed by Q&A with Kerr Neilson, Toby Harrop, and Jacob Mitchell. We know that markets are driven by greed and fear, and it has been interesting to see the rapid shift from one to the other in recent months. The headlines have been loud and clear. Global equities have had their worst quarter since September 2002 in US dollar terms, down 16.5%, and the second worst since 1991. You will be pleased to see that the Platinum International Fund returned a positive 7.5% to investors over the quarter. The current events are not in themselves surprising. We have written at length and discussed the excesses in the system ad nauseam. To go into great depth about the bailout plan, the institutions which went bankrupt and so on would add little. What is important now is what things look like going forward, how we are positioned and how the world has changed. We wrote in July about the market's tendency to fixate on an issue. For now, the crisis is getting the attention oil was only months ago. And we capitalized on that with a nice trade in the US airline sector. Now we can capitalize on the crisis mentality by focusing on great companies that have been sold down. Anticipating the meltdown was starting to make us sound permanently bearish. We are not. The market sell-off is throwing up some great opportunities to invest in some of the best companies in the world at bargain prices. For example, the following global leaders are on single-digit trailing PEs. Samsung Electronics, Singapore Airlines, BMW, Shell, Sony, and Denso, an auto parts supplier affiliated to Toyota. Microsoft is on 10 times earnings if we deduct its $40 billion in excess cash. And Warren Buffett has been becoming more active in the markets in recent weeks. The global markets appear to be on a PE of about 11 times forward earnings. The long-term average is about 15 times, but earnings have been very stretched, and there will be some reversion to the mean. But now, a 30% or so earnings decline is priced in, so we should presumably be less negative than we were. Coming into this environment, being cognizant of the risks in the system, means that the investments we have been making and the themes we have been developing have been chosen with the world we now face in mind. That of slower growth, deleveraging of Anglo consumers, and the financial system in general. The multitude of warning signs were evident. From an Australian perspective, it now seems laughable that private equity was bidding for Qantas, or the complex debt-ridden structures being promoted by various local operators that were being lapped up by investors, infrastructure funds, property developers, so-called safe havens, enhanced yields, etc. They all seem like a different time, and how easy it is to now say they were crazy. Where things were tough for us in the second quarter this year were that despite the ructions in the financial system, the global investing public was still a believer that this time it's different for resources and for China, the unstoppable growth machine. And this propped up the Australian dollar for far longer than one would have expected in a slowing environment, giving a sense of comfort in the local market. Watching the Kiwi dollar was telling the real story very clearly. When this finally broke, the severity was inevitable. However, we were getting queries earlier in the year from investors in Perth, the Australian heart of the resources boom, who could not see why one would invest in anything other than local resource stocks and how mad we were for looking offshore, making it clear that this was only a matter of time. I think it's now worth going through some of the major exposures in the portfolio. It's worth stressing that we have been preparing for this turmoil for some time, and therefore it's not a time of massive change and activity in our holdings. However, while the broader themes are set, we expect screening to throw up the marginal idea. The transfer of wealth from west to east has been core for us over many years, and the fund has 35% exposure to Asia, including Japan. Looking at the build-up of reserves in the East shows that this process is in full swing. We still believe the Japanese investor will regain interest in their market at some point, while perhaps the rest of us have a Japanese-style 20-year workout ahead of us. Data and mobility is a big theme for us. We have over 20% in technology companies, including Ericsson, SAP, Samsung, Microsoft and Cisco. Infrastructure remains a major theme as the West is forced to upgrade while developing nations are being built. Bombardier, Siemens and Schneider Electric are among our exposures to this. We still see relative value in the pulp and paper complex over the metals and minerals, with 5 or 6% here, and we retain some exposure to gold, which has been useful portfolio insurance in recent weeks. Looking a few years out, the emergence of the Asian consumer is real. In particular, the rebalancing of the Chinese economy away from investment, government spending and exports means that the consumer will be the fastest growing segment. And we play this through international brands such as BMW, Pernod Ricard and Singapore Airlines. And local Chinese companies such as aviation IT company TravelSky Technology, a beneficiary of increased flying, and car companies such as Denway and Dongfeng. The emergence of alternative energy and the green theme will continue to grow, and we have built a good understanding here and nibble at solar and other related stocks when the valuations allow. Although the index and the huggers thereof will have 20% exposure to financials, we do still have over 10% long and 7% net exposure to banks and brokers, but not to those in America, Australia or the UK other than on the short side. Instead, we own the likes of MUFJ in Japan, Bangkok Bank and other Asian entities with strong balance sheets. Additionally, we own several property stocks long in Asia and short in the US. We are not calmed by the prognostications of Wayne Swan and Kevin Rudd about how safe the Australian banks, which rely on overseas funding, really are. And the local obsession with frank dividends from these organisations makes it hard for them to do what is right and cut these back, whilst providing a false image of value. We favour big stocks over small, quality companies over weak, and see sectors like healthcare and media, which have had several years of purgatory, starting to gain more investor attention. There are still areas, however, that look vulnerable. In particular, smaller companies in America have held up well, and half of our short position targets this. On the currency front, we've been increasing exposure to the yen and the US dollar at the expense of Asian currencies and to a lesser extent the euro. The case for owning the Asian currencies was predicated on Chinese revaluation, fighting inflation, i.e. higher interest rates, and massive trade surpluses. The outlook for these have changed. The Eurozone is also experiencing a slowdown and is much less of a must-own than it was earlier in the year. Note, over the last 100 years there's been a very strong relationship between the US stock market going up and US households taking on more debt. This tends to point to a tough time ahead for markets where debt has driven the economy. Notwithstanding that, it's the change in leadership, the change in the composition of economies, and the change in patterns of growth that will throw up the opportunities. And as for China and its endless growth, well, the market still appears to hold the view that the Chinese government will sort everything out. 9% growth remains unanimous. But with 30% of the economy being exports and a slowing property market, it's hard to see us avoiding a general disappointment down the track. And that will also impact on resources which rely on endless increasing demand from China. Admittedly, the domestic Chinese market has fallen 60%, so there may soon be some opportunities. But returning from a recent visit, we are not quite salivating yet, expecting the reality of a slowdown will still impact sentiment further. Investing is all about a philosophy, a process, and a mentality. We eschew fashion and focus on neglect. The current environment is developing into one which we believe more and more plays to our style. We must stress that while many fund managers are scrambling to adjust their portfolio for a new world, we have built our portfolio in advance with this scenario in mind. I will now hand over to Keir, Toby and Jacob for your questions. Thank you.
If you would like to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypad now. Our first question is from Andrew Ott. Please go ahead.
Oh, good afternoon. I'd like to hear your comments. To what extent are you concerned about the systemic risk in terms of for the derivatives and the counterparty exposure that exists in the banking system and the financial system around the world?
That's exactly what the markets have been responding to. Andrew. I mean, the whole sell-off we're seeing is to some extent already taken that into account. The question we have is what really liquefies the commercial paper markets and so on. Because if the banks, as we believe, are bereft of adequate capital, if they are, the governments can step in and take a fair bit of ownership or entire ownership. The more difficult question is, how do you keep the commercial paper markets alive and transparent? And that is what this coordinated interest rate cut's about. And as I say, do not underestimate the prospects that we'll see more nationalizations. And then if the governments are running these institutions, they can have a greater say in who gets credit and who doesn't and so on. It's not a perfect solution, but as we've seen under the capitalist model, it's not been perfect either. But we think most of the concerns are already pretty well expressed in share prices right now.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Tom Dore. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Keir, the market's been driven by fear at the moment. How long do you think that's going to continue?
The important thing we're focusing on, there are two things. One is profits are coming from very, very high levels, unprecedented high levels, so we must expect many disappointments on the earnings front. The second thing is that we are in a period of retrenchment by consumers in many countries, and as a consequence, demand will be pretty poor. And in many countries that we look at, the developed world, we think they'll be in several quarters of declining activity. But of course, the market does anticipate this and is already doing so to a large extent in our view. So we wouldn't have thought that you can get out of this problem very quickly, because unlike a typical recession, we haven't had the bad debts yet. We've simply had a loss of faith in counterparties. So this is a finance-led upset, which then works its way through the real economy. So our view is that you're in a period of perhaps 8 quarters, 2 years of very flat or poor economic conditions for the developed world, and still growth in the developing world, but again at lower rates. And certainly we feel that the expectations of China are far too high still.
Yeah, just following that up, what are your predictions for the Chinese growth?
Well, if you think that the economy has a consumption function of about under 40% and the rest is exports and investment, and the investment was pretty much wild capitalism at its best, there will be evidence later that there's been massive overinvestment in certain areas, one of which, of course, will be property. So to answer the question directly, we're thinking in terms of 6 or 7%, but not the 9% that is a very firm consensus.
Thanks, Keir.
Our next question is from Andrew Outridge. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Kurt, look, I'm just wondering if there's any specific signs that you're looking for or expecting to maybe indicate when the bottom might be coming.
I'd like the others to help me answer these questions as well. But, I mean, just on the bottoming mentality that we still have, that suggests to me that we will see some bounces here, but I believe it'll be more protracted than that, because when people still talk about finding bottoms, invariably it'll be longer in the formation than we'd like to believe. But it is true that you've had extraordinary deterioration in valuations, and in some instances we're finding stocks that are at levels they were 20 years ago. And I'm not talking about companies that haven't grown in that 20 years. Those companies that we're interested in have grown over that period and consistently grown, and yet such has been their revaluation downwards that they are being priced no more than they were that time ago. So rather than answering your question directly, because I think it's not going to be easy to answer, it can be flippant, but it can't be helpful. In managing money, what we have to do is find those stocks which have been repriced so violently that we can make money out of them. Because remember why we've made money for you since the June financial year end. The PIF, International Fund, is up 12%. Why that is so is the composition of the portfolio and the currency aspect, which was going so hard against us in the previous 12 months, has now gone in our favor. So rather than trying to be so clever as to give you, and in fact it's impossible for anyone to answer, when the bottom will be, what we can focus on is the fantastic stocks we can buy at good value. Now you'll say, well, how do you know what is absolutely great value? That we can't know, but if something has grown for 20 years and is the same price as 20 years ago, I suggest you're pretty close to fine value.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question is from Nathan Vick. Please go ahead.
Yes, Kerr. You talked about the link between the ban of short selling and the functioning of the futures market in your piece a few weeks ago. Can you briefly expand on what the outflow is from the short selling ban onto the futures market and how it impacts what you're doing within the portfolio?
Well, if you start playing with the markets in terms of you allow people to go long and you can't short sell, you have all sorts of issues with your derivatives and your ETFs and so on. So you really do start removing some of the agents from the game. It hasn't affected us because we've lost interest in shorting the financials and are much more interested in going now after the so-called defensives. So it's a matter of how you play your shorting approach. We did the same thing in the meltdown after the tech bubble, or of the tech bubble, where we migrated persistently across the different segments, and that's what we're doing here. So we've lost interest in financials, we're going after other things. But in a broader sense, as you're seeing, I mean, in Russia they don't even bother to discourage short selling, they simply close the exchange. So, and by the way, as Jacob says in about Japan, you know, here's this dysfunctional economy that everyone likes to bag. Their banks have got cash, they've got a surfeit of deposits, and they haven't introduced any of these artificial constraints on market movements. So, I mean, we just have a roundabout when you play the markets, and you've just got to be aware that the music keeps playing, and we just keep changing the words, or vice versa.
So the bottom line is it hasn't really affected your portfolio or future construction?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
There are currently no questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypad now. Our next question is from Tom Dore. Please go ahead.
Kerr, just looking at your Platinum Asia Fund, you sort of mentioned or referred to earlier that the Asian currencies were looking a bit, I suppose, sort of precarious at the moment, but it doesn't appear that you've necessarily hedged away from them, although you've got a fairly large exposure to Singapore by the looks of it. Could you just explain, please?
We wrongly believe that the Asian currencies would appreciate with the others. But fortunately, we started changing our position when we felt that we were on the wrong line of reasoning. And quite recently, we've been buyers of the Australian dollar. So we have shifted that towards Australian, not entirely, but we have cut the position in some of these Asian currencies.
Thank you. And you've been pretty critical of resource shares, but shares like BHP and Rio, that I mean, obviously the earnings predictions may not eventuate, but they're trading on P's of around about 5 or 6 at the moment. Are those companies not reasonable value at the moment?
They look interesting, but what we keep talking about is normalized earnings. Like the banks here, I mean, as Doug said in his talk, I mean, the dividends are probably higher than is sensible given the constraints they have in terms of their mismatch of borrowings and lendings and their requirements for anticipated write-downs that they will have. But on the resource side, we just ask you to consider the assumptions you're making about this endless growth in places like China and India. And in particular, we were very critical of the belief that the steel industry would continue to expand at 10% a year, which is 50 million tons a year, which is a greater output than the whole of Germany, for example, which produces about 40 million a year. We were simply highlighting the problems that people were extrapolating. At these values, I suspect they're getting quite more interesting, but I think you want to normalize the copper price, and you don't want it up in $3 a pound. You want it somewhere between $1 and it's $3. Iron ore, we think if you make $30 to $40 a ton, put those into your equation rather than the $100 a ton you might be making on the spot, or $150 you're making on the spot. On the energy price, we were quite clear that the oil price would be coming back to about $80, and we think that's where we're going. The one area of the energy which may surprise us on the upside is on natural gas. We think that's a commodity that need not be priced at parity with the oil content, and so on. So you've put in those numbers, which adjust for what we call trend prices, and see what your PE is. I don't think it's then 5.
And the other thing I'd add is the if you look at the valuation of BHP, last time I looked, it was on around about 3x sort of book. And, you know, we can buy in Japan resource companies with equivalent sort of quality assets at sort of 20% discounts to book. So that's where we're currently sort of exposed.
Okay. Big difference. And last time, I think you mentioned that you were shorted to the Russell 2000. How much further do you think the U.S. market's going to drop?
That's the same question we've been asked by every listener. I think here, the Intermarket's activity last night, was interesting. I think this coordinated interest rate cut is a sign that you're getting all central banks starting to work more closely together and looking at ways of as I say, re-liquefying these commercial bill markets and so on. So I think we can see some pretty violent moves on the upside from time to time. The more difficult question, as I say, is how prolonged the sort of bottoming process is. But I think you can see some very strong bounces periodically, as we saw in Japan. You know, you had the first big sell-off, then you had some quite nice bounces, another sell-off and another very large bounce. So that's the sort of environment I think we're in. And the skill we have to bring to bear is to keep migrating our shorts and keep adjusting for that. And then the other important component that has been so profitable for us is to get the currency right. And as I say, at this sort of level, we're interested in the Australian dollar. Last time round, we were very big buyers of the dollar around 50 cents. We started cutting our position around 70, and really had, by the time it got to 80, it looked like we had too few dollars because it kept on going into the 80s. So, you know, that's the difficult part of our job. I think from your perspective, you know, don't believe that you're putting money to work and then the currency, if it goes up, is going to necessarily detract from your investment, because it very much depends what we do in terms of changing our view on the Australian dollar. And right now, we're thinking it's sold off quite enough.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Gary Morgan. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Question for Kerr. Kerr, there's been some commentary recently about the effect of sovereign wealth funds selling out of markets, driving the markets down in an attempt to raise cash. How concerned should we be about these huge funds doing this?
I haven't seen any reference to that, and I'd be astonished if they were in that mode. I think their problem is that some of them have gone too early in trying to bail out some of the financial institutions. I think what we will be watching, or sorry, what we are watching is when they start buying some of these industrial companies, which give them a hedge against likely inflation several years down the track. I think the inevitable consequence of all this infusion of cash and the dropping of repos as a way of solving the problem will be that we do have some pent-up inflation. And this extraordinary skill exercised by the central banks, that will result ultimately in some inflation. That's not a near-term threat. But if I were a sovereign fund, that's the one way I'd try to protect myself, is real assets, and it wouldn't be necessarily property. It would be these productive entities like the Siemens of this world, just as the Gulf States bought companies like Thyssen and Daimler-Benz in the 1974 oil bubble. So I think that's where we think it'll be, but we haven't heard of them being active in dumping stocks at all.
Oh, okay. And just further on the comment that you made that you're actively now buying Australian dollars, so just to expand on that, you believe that the dollar is going to gain some ground from this point forward, do you?
I'm simply saying that we will face a period of declining activity in this country in all prospect. And in that event, even though our terms of trade will turn down, our balance of payments could improve somewhat. And when you think back when the currency was last at 66, 67, it was a somewhat different environment, and I think you could justify owning the currency at this level, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Our next question is from Peter Mill at 72 Financial. Please go ahead, Peter.
Yes, thank you. Sorry. My question was, you've mentioned, you know, some aspects about Asia, etc. Are you able to give us any greater detail with respect to the strategy that you're likely to follow for the Platinum Asia Fund? It has performed very well in a relative sense, but I'm just interested if you can give us some greater detail on the strategy going forward for Platinum Asia, please.
Well, what we've done is, up till quite recently, held a fair amount of cash in anticipation of market values coming better, more attractive for us, and we've now started to buy opportunistically. So some of the companies we're seeing have come off 60%, and we do believe that several countries in Asia will continue to grow, and we're looking at domestic operations particularly rather than those exposed to exports. And there have been one or two quite good opportunities as things have just been thrown out. So we've reduced the cash position to around 15%. In terms of the currencies, we will earn more Australian dollars.
Thank you.
We will what?
Own.
We will buy more Australian dollars at reasonable levels.
I understand that. Thank you.
Our next question is from John Mallory. Please go ahead, John.
Two questions, Keir. First, can you comment on the consolidation of the Australian banking system, considering your reluctance to engage the sector to date? And secondly, if you can comment about what's happening in Europe with Eurosceptics saying that the euro as a currency will have problem going forward to and the consequent performance of your European fund.
Well, just on the consolidation of the banks, I mean, that's going to be happening worldwide. Here, the issue is these banks are deficient in natural deposits, and the game has changed now, and the product managers are less active, and the deposit seekers are now the kings of the banks, or should be very soon if they're not already. So the consolidation, we can't really comment on it, but we're talking about valuations. Everywhere else in the world we look, we can buy banks at less than book value with a big deposit basis in places like Thailand and so on, and Japan. So we have no interest in buying banks which are twice book and deficient in deposits. In Europe and the whole euro structure, one of the things that's coming from this crisis is just seeing how big these banks are in relation to their domestic economies. For example, Deutsche Bank is something like 75% of the size of the German economy. So this is where some of your problems and tensions are rising. But we are of the view that the euro will weaken further against the US dollar and are not fully loaded with euro in relation to the stocks we own there. So in other words, we've already reduced the holding of euro relative to our physical holdings in Europe itself.
Right.
Can you comment
a little bit about India in terms of banking? Apparently, banks in India are far more cheaper than here, and generally speaking, about the Indian economy.
I didn't catch that on India. It's Toby Harrop calling. I was just going to comment a little further on the euro and the European situation. I mean, keep in mind that the euro against the Aussie has tended to trade around 58 to 62 cents for the last several years. Today it's at 50 cents, the Aussie dollar. So to the extent that it impinges on us, I mean, we like to see, for the European companies we own, the euro weakening, particularly against the yen, but also against the US dollar. That helps Siemens, BMW, Schneider, these sort of names we've talked about and we own both in the international fund and in the European portfolios. From a valuation point of view in the portfolios, you know, we're starting to increase the hedge again, Aussie against the euro at 50 cents. That looks pretty attractive to us, 50 euro cents per Aussie. I think the difficulty in Europe that you see is the structure of the currency, of what happens when you lock all of the countries into one system. So Spain has a current account deficit that makes Australia's and America's look modest, and yet the currency is unable to change price against its principal trading partners, which are, of course, the other Europeans. And that places great strain on the Spanish economy to adjust the hard way, you know, productivity and deflation and years of not going anywhere. So I think it's in that, and it's also in the disagreement over the weekend of the Europeans unable really to come up with a Euroland solution. We always think of that as a fictitious reference anyway. When there's trouble, Germany acts for Germany and France for France, etc., etc., and that's what you've seen again. But a weakening euro is welcome on almost every score that we can see for the moment. If you'd like to repeat your question on Indian banks, I apologise for interrupting.
Yeah, what value do you see in India going forward, in simple terms? The Indian market has backtracked as well, not as bad as China. But again, they are rumored to be about 10 years behind anyway. So is India a good bet for the future?
So Jacob Mitchell, I sort of take care of the Japan fund, but once upon a time I looked at India quite closely. The issue, I think, is that, you know, India falls into the sort of current account deficit group of countries in Asia. Sort of you put Korea in that group. You know, they now have weakening currencies and they still have quite high inflation, although, you know, inflation will probably start declining with commodity prices. But their credit growth, the reason they have those current account deficits is credit growth has been averaging 20% in the case of India, much higher than GDP growth. And their banks have, to a certain extent, become dependent on, you know, external sources of funding. So the largest, you know, one of the largest private banks, ICICI Bank, you know, it has the same sorts of issues that we've seen in Europe and in the US in terms of depositors getting concerned about their money. And I just think India will go through a longer sort of correction process than most people expect.
Thank you.
The Q&A session has now concluded. Please email any further questions to invest@platinum.com.au and you will be contacted by a Platinum representative. This concludes today's conference call. Thank you all for attending.
Thanks very much.